Our next speaker is a sister that I am so happy to have met after having talked with her on the phone for many months. Her name is Maxine Alexander. She's the Maxine support. She's the editor of the anthology Speaking for Ourselves, Women of the South, and also We Are Here Forever, Indians of the South. She's a published poet, mother, and human rights activist with a special emphasis on issues of women and children. Please welcome Maxine from North Carolina.
Hello. I realized that I was going to have to cut my presentation short, but it's okay because everybody said some of the stuff, so I was sitting there crossing out things. I want to start off by defining a couple of words that we use quite often, and the reason I want to define them is because they may mean something different to everybody in the room. So I'm picking those definitions of the word that I'll be using within the context of my presentation. The first word is radical, which means of or from the root or roots, going to the center, foundation or source of something, fundamental, basic, favoring fundamental or extreme change, specifically favoring such change of the social structure. The second word is vision, the power of perceiving something not actually present to the eye, whether through supernatural insight, imagination, or by clear thinking. And I've titled this presentation, Radical Vision. Among various African people, it is traditional to have many names. The name your mother calls you may be different from the one used by your peers, your siblings, your grandparents, or your children. Other names may reflect stages of your growth, your experiences, or achievements. Similarly, among Native Americans, a name or vocation may be revealed to you on a vision quest. I think of these traditions when I reflect on the many names of Malcolm. In his vision quest, Malcolm truly made the radical choice. He went to the root, found the source, and began in earnest to work on making that change, and he asked us to call him brother. Brother Malcolm was a man whose sincerity and integrity were unquestionable, so that even those who rejected his views grew to respect and admire him, and some of us to love him. He became a beloved brother to people involved in liberation struggles all over the world. But before Brother Malcolm became an international figure in the struggle for liberation, he underwent a number of transformations which offer us lessons to incorporate into our ongoing movement. From an early life of violence, abandonment, poverty, and fear, Malcolm was transformed from victim to victimizer. In my work with the National Child Rights Alliance, victims and survivors of child abuse, I came to recognize this as a common occurrence. A community, a society, which allows the abandonment, abuse, neglect, and exploitation of the children in its midst, which ignores their rights and crushes their humanity, creates an adult who is likely to copy that behavior. For loyalty, love of community, love for self, and respect for life are demonstrated with actions, not words. And if no one reaches out to a child in pain, that child will grow up to strike out at that society, at that community, at oneself. As African Americans, we are comfortable sometimes with the truism that violence and oppression breed more violence and oppression, as long as the perpetrator is the white man. We are still resistant to an examination of the oppressive behavior we have absorbed into our culture. As a group, we tend to deny that sexual, emotional, and physical abuse is more than an occasional aberration in our community. It is not occasional. It is frequent, and it is deadly. Children are not committing suicide, drinking alcohol, taking drugs, and running away from home by the thousands because of peer pressure or television. But because they're in pain and we're not listening. And so our children are in training schools, and when I tried to find out what they trained them for, somebody told me prison. foster homes, prisons, and the streets, where they continue the cycle of violence which began in their own homes and communities, that not surprisingly have too often become microcosms of the hierarchical, oppressive, and violent system we struggle so hard to change. How radical is that change? How close to the root, to our foundation, are we coming when we deny children their basic human rights and refuse to acknowledge their oppression? Our brother Malcolm broke that cycle of violence and self-hatred, and his life gives us hope. We should be mindful of the fact that the violence that invaded his home came from outside, from the ones that we can acknowledge as the oppressor. But ask yourself where he and we would be if the oppressor, the perpetrator of violence against his family, had been a member of his family. How swiftly could he have healed? But Malcolm did heal. Incarcerated, prison became his university as the streets had been his high school and college. His transformation came about through study. He began to read to try to understand the world and himself in it. He often said he read thousands of books while in prison. When he was exposed to a philosophy which taught self-love, self-knowledge, discipline, responsibility for self, for family, for community, and which sought to restore dignity to the sons and daughters of slaves in North America, he underwent another transformation. And therein lies our second lesson. Study, knowledge, the word, Nomo, has the power to transform. Malcolm was no longer interested in being an exploiter, an abuser of self and others, that is a life of the street hustler and pimp. He became the Nation of Islam's most powerful spokesman. Malcolm's way of teaching the Muslim message of self-love, self-knowledge, and self-sufficiency moved us. Because of his example, we strove to do better, to be better, and some of us were. I first heard Malcolm X in person in 1963 at CCNY. I'm not that old, I was a spirit. The way he could talk about the white man, it reminded me of the kind of talk I'd often heard from my people in North Carolina. The white man ain't nothing but the devil, they tell each other, while each one outdid the other, relating some act of injustice, incompetence, or treachery. But this man wasn't sitting on the porch or in the kitchen or under the tobacco shed. He was saying it to their faces, and plenty of their faces were there. They lined the walls, particularly the Jewish students who I suppose took issue with Islam. Malcolm's speech was, as usual, a mixture of history, myth, heavy on the myth, humor, and a burning intensity about the injustices suffered by the black man. He was still spokesman for the Nation of Islam at that time. Interestingly, these students did not discuss his criticism of white violence and the historical and continuing oppression of blacks in America, but chose to attack the religious doctrines of the Nation of Islam. Obviously, their attacks were motivated by something other than a desire for theological clarity. It would be hard to suppose that they expected to apply a logical critique to a creation story. If you do it with Yaqub, you'd have to do it with Adam and Eve. But I guess the shock of being a called devil to their faces by a self-assured black man was too overwhelming to the intellectual white community, particularly as they probably considered themselves quite liberal. Malcolm remained unshakable and unruffled in spite of their persistence, for they monopolized the question and answer period. I did sense, though, that he was impatient, mostly because of the show of patience, which seemed a bit exaggerated. After the presentation, we went upstairs to the student NAACP office for coffee. It was a long time ago, and that was the only black organization on campus. And that's when we met the real Malcolm. He pulled out an overstuffed notebook of documents, newspaper and magazine clippings, and proceeded to teach. That man could teach. The particular topic was the March on Washington. It was after that nightmare summer of 1963 when the youth-led Southern rights movement finally reached the eyes of the world through the media. Malcolm showed us how what had begun as a popular mass movement had been co-opted by the Kennedy administration and turned into a media event which would place the president in a favorable light, but which offered no changes for the masses. Malcolm's intensity and commitment were both magnetic and contagious. Encounters with him have stirred many people from apathy to become lifelong freedom fighters. From my encounter with him, I learned that to teach is more powerful and empowering than to command. Thank you. In spite of my admiration for some of the Nation of Islam's programs, I was never able to accept their concept of leadership. My childhood experiences had made me suspicious of absolute power, and my common sense made me reject divine rulers. Giving up the right to think for myself, to question and to make decisions, frightened me. The suggestion that I should angered me, and still does. As I have gained more experience through community organizing and working in social change organizations, I've become even more convinced that we need to re-examine our notions about leadership. I am even more committed to collective leadership. When we insist upon, not consensus, Sam. When we insist upon making heroes, saints, messiahs, and prophets out of our leaders, we are depriving them of their humanity. We are priving ourselves of clarity of vision. We become guilty of myth-making, an activity which weakens liberation struggles because it suggests that our movement cannot survive the truth. It also is a way of avoiding responsibility, for there are times when we all must lead and times we must follow. Strengthening our movement requires continuous and open and honest communication. Only through loving and respectful critique can we develop strategies for overcoming our common oppression. As Malcolm said in the final week of his life, all of us should be critics of each other. Whenever we can't stand criticism, you can never grow. This holds true for our movements and organizations as well as for individuals. Malcolm stated in the last week of his life that he regretted not having spoken up sooner about corruption within the organization he loved, for which he had become the most persuasive spokesman. He felt responsible for the people that he had helped to recruit. Surely this must be the hardest lesson of all, to speak out about injustices committed by people you love, to question their veracity, to question their motives, to question their wisdom. It's hard because you will be isolated, maligned, ridiculed, slandered, perhaps even killed. But if our movement cannot withstand the truth, then in truth, we have no movement. Individuals or organizations that discourage or disallow criticism are determined not to grow. This next session I call Women as Partners, Not Property. A deeply disturbing flaw within our struggle for liberation has been the continuing failure to acknowledge the negative impact that the devaluation of women has had on our overall society, on our communities, on our families, and by natural extension, on our movement. It is imperative that we take up the challenge to engage in a principled analysis of the gender-based role-playing that is crippling us. The Nation of Islam taught that men should provide security and protection for their women. And this gave some comfort to many of our beleaguered, battered, and exhausted sisters. Many were happy to trade the right to free will, free speech, and full participation in the decision-making process, which would affect their lives, for economic security and a promise of protection. Others of us, though equally beleaguered, battered, and exhausted, could not tolerate being told what to say, to read, to think, do, or wear, or to allow someone else to make those decisions for us because of genital configuration. Or, or divine right. This insistence on female subservience and dependence suggested the same property relationship that existed in slavery. How then is it possible to hate slavery for one segment of the community and prescribe it for the other? It was and is shocking to me that so many men and women were and are hostile to the idea of women's equality. I was confused by that, and yet not able to speak on it with any kind of clarity or courage in the 60s. I had, like everyone else, bought into some of the gender role playing, but not enough to avoid being attacked. When I did speak up, and my experience was not uncommon, I was called variously an agent, a lesbian, a mixed breed trying to start trouble among the real black people, and brainwashed by the white bitches. These were interesting choices. Black women have always been blamed for having had the gall to insult black men by being raped by white men during the era of bondage, thereby mongrelizing the race. We and white men, they said, were free while they and white women were not. The implication that sex with a powerful man somehow makes one free, for sex at that, we need to deal with that. White men, the argument goes, were powerful because they had access to and control over all the women. Black men were not free because they had to have the white man's permission to have access to black women and could not have access to white women. White women were not free because, poor things, they could only be sexually exploited by white men. And we all know that they have these teeny, weeny, weenies. We could use we need a less confused analysis of power. Both the collaborationist and half-breed slander stem from this bit of sick folk myth. Let there be no mistake, there can be no consensual union between master and slave, and by extension, a person with absolute power and authority over another is not having an affair when sexual contact occurs, but is engaging in rape. And I'm talking about adults and children, priests and parishioners, and yes, divine leaders and fellowship. When Malcolm dared to reveal the sexual exploitation of young women in the nation, I felt vindicated. My analysis of gender bias might not have been all that sharp, but I knew about sexual exploitation. Even now, this issue is swept aside as insignificant in the series of events that led to Malcolm's final break with the nation. In all of the proliferation of material on the last year of Malcolm's life, I've never seen it discussed. It has been mentioned because Malcolm mentioned it, but it was rarely commented on. If I'm wrong, will somebody please show it to me? Now the lesbian thing. Why do so many of our brothers assume that if a woman expresses love, concern for, or solidarity with another woman or women, that it must be sexual? And if a woman is a lesbian, will she go rampaging through the community, forcing cunnilingus on a secure, protective, solid and obedient brides of the leaders by divine right? I think not. This accusation is dangerous on two accounts. It divides us and it introduces the dangerous notion that my sister is not my sister if she doesn't have a man. Yeah. the same prejudices cling to all single women. We're considered a threat, our homes are considered broken, and if we have children, we're called female heads of household, like some kind of curse akin to traitor of the race. I've heard a story of an elder black woman who said every time somebody tried to do something for us, they call them communists. Say they communists. Them communists must be all right, huh? Now, if every woman who tries to do something for other women is called a lesbian, those lesbians must be all damn right. I say, thanks for taking the heat, and why isn't everybody trying to do something? As for being influenced by white women, how can African-American men be so articulate about the pain of slavery, exploitation, violence against the race, and assume that we would want liberation for our fathers, lovers, brothers, and sons, but not for ourselves, our mothers, our sisters, and our children? And how can they assume that we had to wait to 1960 to understand the meaning of freedom? We had Anna Cooper, Ida B. Wells, Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, and that was in the 19th century. We had Rosa Parks, Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Baker, you've heard about them. And if you don't know about them, read about them. Betty Friedan, I guess that's how you pronounce her name, and Gloria Steinem were late, incomplete, and somewhat off the mark for our liberation. A sister freedom fighter from Chile once told us that in her home country, men are beaten, tortured, imprisoned, and killed. Women are beaten, tortured, imprisoned, raped, and killed. So are we, my beloved sisters and brothers. And we will settle for nothing less than full liberation. Or as C. Eric Lincoln said recently, we want uppercase freedom. The best protection and security we can offer our partners, children, and community is freedom from fear of abuse at our hands. We would then be psychologically prepared to protect ourselves. The status of women and children as chattel, legally and culturally, must be challenged and changed. Gender bias cripples children, stifles both men and women, and undermines the concept of self-determination, the cornerstone of the liberation struggle. This lesson I could share with you in Malcolm's own words, which were given to us earlier by Vivian. And I would like to add the same thing that our sister Bell Hooks said last night, and that is, nobody gives you freedom, so there was still a little ways to go with this thing, but at least it was recognized that there had been a problem. And finally, I'd like to say a word on unity. The good ship Jesus and the other ships that followed let loose the European hordes to loot, rape, torture, and kidnap our ancestors for fun and profit. The cargo they transported spoke many languages, had a diversity of physical characteristics, represented many belief systems, and included all ages and both sexes. This diversity is our potential strength. We cannot afford to replace the white man's mythology, which denies our existence, deliberately distorts our history and culture, denies us our heritage, with any mythology which seeks to build a positive image by ignoring or demeaning one segment or another of our people, declaring the superiority of one group of us over the other. Neither can we ignore the atrocities, the mistakes, or just plain human failures of individuals, movement strategies, or organizations. Our movement has survived in spite of attempts to place one group above the other. We have endured attempts to claim the superiority of light skin over dark, dark over light, Egyptian king over Alabama sharecropper, doctor over factory worker, married over single, young over old, old over young, male over female, Christian over Muslim, Muslim over Christian, and on and on. And still, our movement survives. Surely, our movement can survive the truth, since it has survived the lies. our various histories, surely we can only benefit from knowing the whole truth of our various histories and heritages, the good, the bad, the painful, the glorious, the great diversity that is us. We know that Malcolm's tour of Africa and the Middle East helped him to understand the global nature of the struggle, and that he then struggled to gain a greater understanding of the true nature of oppression so as to best eliminate it. The OOAAU document attests to the need for broadening the struggle by the very process by which it was developed, a group process, a group effort. Once a major TV network invited Brother Malcolm to speak on a panel with several responsible Negro leaders. They were all men, and I'm proud to say that women had too much sense to be responsible Negro leaders. These perhaps well-intentioned brothers were so intent on attacking Malcolm and disassociating themselves from the ideas he was expressing that they offered little in the way of inspiration or information themselves. Finally, Malcolm threw up his hands, looked at each one of them, and said, "Brothers, brothers, don't we have anything in common?" I say, "Don't we? Oppression is our common bond. An analysis of oppression is our job. Putting an end to oppression is our goal." And those are the lessons I learned from the lives of the beloved brother on my own vision quest.
Thank you.